Welcome to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we have Professor of Economics, Ned Rubens, talking about the pros and cons of the system of capitalism. So please stick around. Thank you.
Now, what I want to start with is the virtues of capitalism before we tackle what is really our problem, namely the shortcomings and failures. Virtue side, the most important matter, I would say, is that at least in the 20th century, American capitalism produced the highest level of living of any whole population in the history of the world. That strikes me as major and hardly arguable, although not everybody enjoyed it, but for the largest part of a whole population, it was an amazing achievement. Now, with that, of course, went the opportunity for various individuals to rise exceptionally high and to put together great fortunes. And there's some question as to what the adverse consequences of that may be. But from the standpoint of opportunity and the standpoint of the middle class with comfort and security and longevity, which we mustn't forget, and satisfactions and pleasures, life was pretty good in the 20th century, and it only raises a big question about what is going to happen next. In fact, I have developed a feeling that the 20th century was probably the high plateau. And after that, the chances are that the American population will never be as happy, as contented, as prosperous as they were in the 20th century. Now, that's, of course, a rather gloomy perspective to make, but I think that it's necessary to do it and to concentrate on what can be done to alleviate the downturn, which is probably going to take place in any case. So that's the general line of argument that I want to make about capitalism and its achievements. But we'll try to focus on the things which have come about that have put an end or have greatly reduced the benefits that capitalism was able to achieve in the last century. Now, what are those? Well, I see three or four different kinds of developments. In the first place, there are certain features of capitalism which are virtually inherent in a system of private ownership and independent business operations, and are worth exploring more carefully. But they are long run, and they've been with us for quite a while, and were operating even in the days when the middle class was doing best. Beyond that, there is the obvious and dramatic rise of China and other less developed countries, which brings in cheap competition, mostly in goods, but to some extent even in services, as modern communications makes it possible for services to be outsourced to those countries. A third thing is we sometimes tend to forget in our short historical view is that a lot of the success in the United States in the 19th century, I'm sorry, in the 20th century, was because of the damages that had occurred in Europe during the two world wars. There was so much dislocation, so much destruction, so much movement of population and so forth, that the European economies really were not recovering until late in the 20th century. During that previous period, the U.S. was in a privileged position, you know, rather similar to what was the case for Japan in the situation of the First World War, when Japan was not devastated but got the benefits of dealing with the victors. Well, the same kind of thing happened later on in the Second World War, and Europe is now a big competitor, Germany, of course, particularly. When we say that, we're really talking then about the rise of globalization, which has been a busy matter of trading and expanding trade over decades, and a couple of centuries really since Adam Smith, but has become wide open in the past couple of decades due to the doctrine, the prevalence of free trade. As long as you believe in free trade, you don't interfere with the flow of commerce. And the flow of commerce coming from countries which can produce the same goods, or very nearly the same goods, for incredibly less cost and selling price, that means that our industries are imperiled. And the result of that imperil is clear in the decline of manufacturing and manufacturing jobs. So we have followed a doctrine, which the economists, of course, have always expounded. But the fact is that free trade is a very tricky thing, which brings damage to producers as well as benefits to consumers, but not as much benefit as they ought to be doing. So workers getting displaced and not offset entirely by the benefits of globalization. Then there is the matter of business cycles. Now, in one sense, business cycles are an old story. They ran all through the 19th century and into the 20th. But they have become more dangerous as a new phenomenon has taken over, namely the functions of finance and the way that the economy is dominated by big financial houses which operate in ways that are good for them and not necessarily good for the economy as a whole, or even very good for many of the operating manufacturing firms that live under that kind of arrangement. So we have seen the worst of those business cycles since at least the Great Depression in what happened to us after 2007, and we're still struggling with it. And finally, there is a long-term trend which is important for employment, and that is that our economy tends to be capital-intensive just because it is a capitalist economy and gets richer and has more capital to employ. And what it does specifically is to replace labor, human labor, with machinery, so that the intensity of capital devices in manufacturing, and of course nowadays in many services, which until recently were not that way, now they are displacing workers in a tendency that can hardly be stopped so long as private enterprise and private capital and independent manufacturing is going to continue and to continue to be the system of the United States. Well, that whole list from the beginning of the inherent shortcomings of capital and through the rise of globalization and the business cycles and the long-term tendency of capitalism makes for really a very big set of problems. And the question now is, what about those? How bad are they? And what can be done about them?
Let me remind our listeners that you're listening to the Logic Consortium and our interview with Professor Emeritus Ned Rubens about the pros and cons of the system of capitalism. He just reviewed some of the long-term trends and problems he sees with capitalism, and later on he's going to talk about what he thinks we need to do about them. So please stick around. Thanks so much.
Now, I could spend quite a long time talking about many of the defects of our system and spelling out many of them, but the time perhaps would not permit. So I will pick out just a few that that strike me as being very important, but not well noticed and appreciated by the general public or even by a good many economists. What I would say broadly is that American capitalism tends toward oligopolies and oligarchies. The government and the nation and our values all tend to be swept up by vigorous expenditures, the dramatic presentations, and sheer nerve on the part of these big companies, which function as oligopolies and become so dominant that we call them oligarchies. Now, what's the harm of that? Well, I would say one thing is that big companies block the numerous small rivals. And we have found that It's the small companies that are mostly innovative. So many of our improvements in actual level of living and in the general middle class styles come from the small companies. And so far as they are blocked by the big companies, we don't get the full benefits of that small operation. Furthermore, the oligopolies, by their essence, avoid price competition. If they were going to compete with one another, they would soon drive profits down to what the economists used to say, minimum profit, namely enough to compensate a manager for what he's doing, but no lavish earnings. Well, it's to avoid that happening that the oligopolies are created and expanded. And in fact, they set high prices, and they compete only in regard to market share by means of advertising and brand names and patents and style changes, all of which are mostly wasteful in themselves, although it's true that advertising supports magazines and perhaps supports public radio and public television. But basically, for the consumer, this is a form of exploitation. And again, corporations tend to hold down wages. There's hardly been any movement upward of money wages since about 1980. Now, that was accomplished partly by crushing the labor unions, and the labor unions to some extent crushed themselves, and by replacing labor with machinery so that you have fewer workers and the firm can run its own affairs more freely, not being dependent on a multitude of human workers. So the result of that has been that wages have been held down. Of course, qualifying that is the fact that a lot of benefits have been put in. And it isn't entirely clear whether the benefits really constitute the equivalent of rising wages. But in any case, it's a bit complex. Another thing that the big companies do is to pollute the environment, because they brush off any complaints. They say if you want production and jobs, you have to accept this pollution, and they resist it as long as they possibly can. Well, of course, until it comes to a case like we see with the auto industry, where their product pollutes the atmosphere and they no longer can survive riding over those objections. So they are going to be changed in some fashion, and the Obama administration is certainly trying hard to control pollution. Now, another thing that happens is that the government itself gets to be controlled by the oligopolies. That's where the oligarchy part of it comes in. And that is because with great wealth and funds to be used for various purposes, the big corporations maintain a system of lobbyists. And those lobbyists, climbing all over Congress in Washington and as much as they can into the White House, and of course, right now, getting a dominant position in the Supreme Court, which is only going to be slightly offset by Sotomayor's appointment. The lobbyists are very influential, and they are more than influential. They are really bribe makers. The campaign contributions, which they give to the congressmen for re-election, and for that matter to the presidential candidates as well, constitute a kind of bribery. You do what I would like, and I will provide you with funds now and for re-election in the future. If you don't go with me, you will have to rely on small contributions. Well, Obama put something of an answer to that by getting a lot of money from small contributions, but it's still not the case that he has freed up the congressman from this bribery technique. And finally, there is a special thing that most people are not aware of regarding the personnel. Many of the people who occupy high posts in the Treasury and in the Securities and Exchange Commission and in the White House itself, as well as in the Congress, many of those people come from the high levels of the oligopolies and work for a while in government doing the, what comes, shall we say, what comes naturally to them, and go back to those companies and get some of the big bonuses that are available there, and sometimes even return once more in and out, as Cheney did and as Rumsfeld has done and other people less prominent. But in the Treasury, which particularly is supposed to regulate business and finance, this presence of interchangeable personnel has brought about much domination of the people who should be the regulators. You know, there's an old Latin tag, quis custodiet ipsos custodes. Who will regulate the regulators? And if we don't have proper regulation of them, the government policy and all the public writings and complainings, including my present talk, come to very little, since there's nobody who really hears them. Now, are you hearing me as I go along?
Oh, yes, for sure.
Okay, now, with all of those things, there are some other features that are more familiar, and I won't stop to talk about them, like the dangers, perhaps mostly in the past, but not entirely today, with regard to oil, that is, the control of suppliers in the markets, leading to imperialism and wars, and the fact that the process of outsourcing, which has become very popular among American firms, is really not very good.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium in our interview with Professor Emeritus Ned Rubens, Professor of Economics, talking about some of the problems that he sees over the long term with our capitalistic system in the United States. And now he's going to tell us what he thinks might be some constructive changes. So please stick around.
I think I've come now to tell you more about what I think could be constructive. What could remedies that would come forth? Some of these are only, I'll list only some things that are being talked about because, in fact, there are quite a lot of them, and I'm not in favor of all of them, and I don't know whether anybody is going to support some of them. For example, there's some talk about nationalizing the banks. However, the answer that's generally given to the nationalization proposals is that socialism. What Americans think is socialism is hard to know. Whether they think it means living in the desperate situations that were prevailing in Russia under Stalin, or whether they know something about theoretical socialism, for which there is an elaborate literature. But in any case, businesses are able to draw on fears and scare people off and worry, make people worry that nationalizing is some foul, overwhelming, terrible thing. Well, I don't think we can easily overcome that. My only suggestion is that we could make some temporary and partial nationalizations in which the government takes over for a while and turns the firms back later on after the practices and regulations have been put into effect. But nationalization is probably not a serious thing for this country. What is closer to our traditions is antitrust breakup. Now, a particular article by a very brave economist named Simon Johnson, he wrote an article in the Atlantic magazine in May of this year, in which he advocated breaking up the big financial Wall Street firms. That's a very radical idea, and breaking them up presumably means antitrust breakup. Well, we haven't had very good results with that. Our federal government broke up A&T grocery chain. They broke up the A&T telephone system. In a sense, they broke up the managed, controlled airline system in the under Carter, when my friend Fred Kahn was the breaker-upper. But the success, the results of all of those have not been very good. And so antitrust may not accomplish much, or it may seem to do something, but it very, very quickly the trusts reestablish themselves. What we seem to have instead is bailouts by the government, which can draw on a Federal Reserve. And incidentally, many people don't seem to recognize yet, when they worry about federal debt and how Obama's spending tends to add to the national debt, they don't understand the national debt, and they talk about how will we ever repay. Fact is, we never repay. We have never really repaid any of the national debt except the small amount after the Second World War of the special funding to fight a war. But in ordinary years, we add to the national debt, sometimes a lot, sometimes a little bit, but we don't repay it. We do pay the interest on the debt, and that has gotten to be a substantial figure. But it's nothing like repaying the national debt, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 trillion. The whole output of the United States, the gross national product, is only about $13 or $14 trillion. So that the notion that we can somehow repay the debt in a rapid pattern is absolutely nonsense. And there's no reason why it has to be done. The national debt is increased when the government has to do more spending, and if spending is sensible and makes the economy recover from recessions and other troubles, that's the right thing to do, and we simply add to the burden of interest, but that is only 5% of the principal, so that we can manage it. Now, the other thing that government can do, of course, is to set rules. There is a kind of implicit rule that most banks have adopted about how much capital to keep in relation to their obligations. Well, those rules have been swept aside in the rush and excitement of the big boom when the housing bubble was roaring and when all the rest of the instrument inventions, the derivatives and so forth, were yielding such big gains to the inventors. Those capital ratios to obligations are now down to about 1%. Well, that rule can be set up and made enforceable. It's possible for regulators to look at every bank and for that matter, every private corporation, and say, your capital ratio is below the minimum, you've got to do something. You either have to sell something or avoid incurring any further debt or borrowing enough to build up your holdings of capital against the obligations and risks that you are running. So the fact that risks got to be very high when the employees of Wall Street firms were getting their bonuses based on the short-term achievement, it made them take very high risks. Those risks should be held down by a variety of measures, one of which is higher capital ratios to obligations.
Professor, sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to ask you a quick question. With regard to globalization, a lot of people talk about how outsourcing and mechanization can lead to job creation in other service sectors. And they talk about the farm industry around the year 1900, when 90% of American workers were in the farm industry at the time. And if you said, if everything was going to be mechanized, where would all the workers go? So people say that the new industry can be created. And then also, in general, globalization allows each country to use their comparative advantage to supply goods and services more cheaply. Can you comment on these arguments a little bit?
A couple of points that make that argument rather weak. First place, the other sectors that might possibly be affected by this flow of manufacturing abroad and consequent demand for American something or other here, the fact is those countries are not going to buy the expensive stuff that are still worth making in this country. Most of the jobs that might be created would be in services that are in some degree good for Americans, but are not services that will satisfy the foreigner. And we, with our import surplus, are on balance not going to benefit ourselves in any direct way. The possibility for getting any benefit that some people seem to think would have held in the old days when trade from America, exports from America were strong and America had a high lead. Of course, we still have some exports, but it's nothing like it used to be in relation to the size of the economy, and therefore we're not going to make up by exporting goods in any large volume. The tendency is the other way, where you're going to export less and less as the foreign countries learn how to make one thing after another and sell them to us because they're cheaper. Now, I suspect that some of the people who make the argument you're sketching out have in mind to keep out goods that are competing with Americans. And that raises a whole different question about tariffs and quotas and quality control, which means that the volume of activity on the whole will be less and prices will be higher and nobody will be better off. They'll be much worse off under a system of protectionism. So I would say in answer to those people you're raising, you're referring to, that because of the import surplus that we persist in having, and because the manufacturing items are the ones that get traded, and those we are being undersold rather than expanding market, that under those circumstances, the outsourcing is simply one piece of the importation of foreign-made goods, meaning now really goods, not services. The services side of it is another story, and I should be adding here that most of the people who are losing their jobs in manufacturing are not going to get jobs in the good sectors that will still persist. That is, a man coming off the assembly line for General Motors is not going to get a job teaching in the university. He's not going to do brain surgery or heart surgery. He's not going to develop mathematical formulas for safe and reliable investment. He's not going to do law. He's not going to teach. Those people are looking for jobs on the level of the work that they have been doing and are capable of doing. Well, job creation in other sectors may well take place, and those Americans, particularly young people who can go through the educational system and qualify themselves to do these highly skilled activities, they will profit to some degree from the world trade activity. But mostly, the expansion in these services is going to be due to domestic American requirements and potentialities. If we work up a new device in electronic communication, or if we work up a new surgical operation that even attracts foreigners to come and get their surgery done here, those are things which are going to expand, but they will not expand in a way that will employ many of the blue-collar workers who had a fine time during the 20th century. That is, I'm back to really the point that we had a temporary halcyon period in which people without any great skills were willing to work, got benefits, rose up in the world, became middle class, and were very happy with it. But all the factors that I have been mentioning since then are working in the opposite direction, and the chances are that we're up against a quite gloomy outlook for labor of the handicraft type, and particularly for certain groups. Namely, I think of young people who are not able to get into services, and particularly young black men who are going to be the most deprived and either ignored or struggled against, because they will be the ones who are most neglected and most disappointed.
This is the Logic Consortium, and that was our interview with economist and professor Ned Rubens. Thanks so much for listening.